Welcome to the Ray Harryhausen Podcast, the show dedicated to the life, career and films of a special effects titan. Join us as we host in-depth discussions about the work, influences and legacy of this uniquely talented filmmaker. Brought to you by the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation, we will be delving into Ray's archive to bring a unique insight into his work, including exclusive audio from the man himself from our own archives. We will be joined by special guests for retrospectives, exclusive announcements and competitions, so this podcast is a must-listen for all fans of the world of Ray Harryhausen, animation and classic filmmaking.
And welcome to episode 47 of the Ray Harryhausen podcast, or number 15 of the Harryhausen podcast, if you're watching by our video channel on YouTube. Now, this is a very special King Kong at 90 special. We're going to be speaking to some of the experts who were present at the Eastern Michigan University, who had a special exhibition on all about King Kong, including Greg Coulon, who's a great friend here of the Foundation, Professor Tom Sukin, and Ben Harry as well. Now, we sent Connor Heaney, our collections manager, out to report on the event and to speak there too. So, Connor, tell me, how did it go?
Thank you, John. Yes, it went very well. My trip to Michigan, to Ypsilanti in Michigan, was a great visit, because what an honor to get to see this material up close and in person, an exhibition of drawings relating not only to King Kong, but to Willis O'Brien and the people that worked on his films. Ray Harryhausen, of course, Jim Danforth, and many more. It was a real celebration of 90 years plus of stop motion animation and the artistry involved in the making of these films.
Excellent. Well, without further ado, let's get started.
So I'm Ben Harry, and I am the curator of audiovisual materials and media arts history at Brigham Young University in Utah in the United States.
And I'm Greg Coulon, and I've just been a longtime Ray Harryhausen and stop motion fan that I've been on another podcast before here, and co-curating this exhibit here today with Professor Tom Sukin, so which we'll be talking about.
Hello, my name is Tom Sukin. I'm a professor of Asian art history at Eastern Michigan University. I'm the co-curator of the King Kong at 90 exhibit with my friend here, Greg Coulon, who I've known since first grade. In middle school and high school, we collaborated on a number of stop-motion films and other films, and we called ourselves Sulan Films at that time. And we've maintained our friendship ever since.
And we always like to say they're filmed in Sulan scope, even if it's just an audio project.
Well, this podcast recording can be in Sulan scope as well. That's something else to add to your IMDb listings there. But it is a lovely story. You two have been friends for so long, and this is a project you're able to work on together. Greg, I just want to ask you a little bit about the origins of this exhibition, which largely comes from your own personal collection.
Yeah, that was the start of it. It probably goes back about... It's probably about close to 5 years now. It was definitely a few years before the pandemic. And Professor Sukin and I, Tom, we were just talking. And I don't exactly know how it came up in conversation, but we probably said, you know, this should be displayed somewhere, and we should do something for King Kong's 90th, right?
Yeah, I think we first had the idea of, like, just, I told Greg, you know, you should show people what you have. You know, it's not doing any good, you know, in your little bedroom there. But so then we kind of came up with the idea, what's coming up? Well, Kong's 90th anniversary was just a few years away, and so we decided let's do it in connection with that.
And my first question was really, do we think we'll be able to get the university to have any interest in this at all? And I was very pleasantly surprised that it seemed like all your grant proposals were accepted for this kind of unique topic.
So very supportive. I wrote a number of small grants through our college and university, and they were all received very well. I think the key was to try to engage students in it, to have students involved. Learning in the classroom, also involved in different aspects of the exhibit. For example, now I have a small grant with a student who's doing docent tours, and then another group of students who are going to run a workshop in about 2 weeks connected with the exhibit.
Okay. But the whole thought was to focus on the visualization of stop motion, not necessarily talk about how the models or armatures are made, but to talk about the early artwork that inspired the films, how the films kind of evolved from the artwork, and also how the artwork then eventually went and sold the films. So you have stuff that was from the creative process all the way to the marketing process. And many of the projects never happened, as in real life. So many projects are never made. And that's probably much more common than the films that do get made. And we wanted to try to tell that story a little bit. And one of the things that happened on very early in the process was, you know, who else could contribute or what else can we do? And we, you know, talked to some friends that have some collections. But I also came to mind was knowing that there was a lot of artwork and at Brigham Young University in the Marion Cooper papers from Willis O'Brien. And I thought, hey, I've met Ben Harry there doing research on the projects for some articles in a Willis O'Brien book, and it would be great to see if we could get another university involved and try to get some of these pieces that have never been seen by anybody on display, at least, you know, never been commonly published. So, and that's how we first started contacting Ben, to see if there was any interest there.
Yeah, and that was very helpful with my university because they do like inter-university collaborations and so reaching out. And so that kind of also helped facilitate the exhibition as well. And then thanks to Ben's help in allowing us to acquire a couple pieces for the exhibit has really made it really special.
Well, that's the perfect segue to Ben. Could you tell us a little bit about your work at Brigham Young University and the Marion Cooper Archive, which I'm sure film fans will be fascinated to hear, not only exists but is being actively curated?
Yeah, we actually have two collections at Brigham Young at BYU that that closely relate to Kong, and the first one we've talked about, and that's the Marion C. Cooper papers, and that is about 68 linear feet of correspondence, personal papers, scripts, films, his own personal copies of Kong and the other films that he's made, and of course artwork, you know, on some of these projects and storyboard work. So it's a really wonderful collection. We did finally have a biographer come and write a biography of Marion C. Cooper. Mark Cottavaz wrote Living Dangerously, and that's a great resource for someone who's interested, and he leaned heavily on what we had because we had so much great material. It's really neat to do primary resource material or research, though, with those things and see, you know, what projects were in development, what things he was doing in his life. He was just quite a figure that, you know, you could make a feature film about. and so, you know, if anyone's interested, you know, we can talk more about Marion Cooper, or you can read about him and look up. The other collection we have that's related to King Kong is we have the Max Steiner collection, which he's probably one of the most prominent film composers of the era. And, of course, with King Kong, the music tells so much of the story and brings to the audience so much of the pathos of Kong and things like that. So he was really instrumental in the collaborative product of King Kong, and the ability, you know, with the animation and the filmmaking and the writing and the music that came together to make just such a classic cinema. So it's really neat. We have the original pencil sketch music for most of Steiner's work. He did score over 300 films, so we have about 180 of those, and it's an immense library. But that's a secondary collection that's also really connected. That's fun to celebrate.
So we'll talk specifically about some of the collection items that you've provided for the exhibit, as well as maybe some of Greg and Tom's highlights as well. But I'm quite interested to know, as a film historian, your thoughts on King Kong at 90 and why this, you know, incredible film which inspired Ray Harryhausen's entire career, why it still looms large in popular culture to this day.
Yeah, well, Kong is amazing because of its lasting legacy. There are so many films that you can watch today and you say, well, this was influential, but audiences won't react to them very well today, modern audiences. But one of the lasting things with Kong is that it was influential in its day, but today when I show it to students or my children, it still has visceral effect on them. It's such a fantastically paced film, and it's just entertainment and larger than life spectacle from the first frame to the last frame, and it really holds up well. And so it's a classic that's really stood this test of time, and that is still going to, I think, influence people going forward, because it's still going to get regular screen time and replay value.
And Greg, you mentioned that too. You know, the date of 2023 was looming large, because you realized, wow, this incredible movie is approaching its 90th anniversary.
Exactly. And what people don't realize is that Kong was not the biggest film of its year when it came out in 1933, and its influence grew over time. If you look at the year-end reports for 1933, Kong did not make the top 10 movies of the year. However, it had very successful re-releases in 1938, 1942, 1952, and 1956. And it is now the biggest grossing movie that was released in 1933, but it didn't make the top 10 then. And people seem to, you know, forget that when they look back at the perspective. 1952 was probably it might have been the most successful re-release of a film in all time, and most influential re-release, because that was at a point where King Kong dominated screens. It was Time's Film of the Year, and what more than that is it inspired the whole genre of. Suddenly you had Ray Harryhausen's Beast from 20,000 Fathoms come out in 1953, in large part because people were willing to put into that because of the 1952 re-release of King Kong being so successful. That led to Godzilla. That led to, Beginning of the End and so many other science fiction films that, you know, when you look at the screens today, what are the popular movies? You have King Kong and Godzilla on the screens today. Probably would not have been there, and I think cinema would be a lot different today if Kong had not even been re-released in 1952.
Well, we've seen from Ray's diaries from 1939 that he had been to see it 31 times already by the age of 19, which is just incredible. But, you know, Ray wouldn't have been the only one. Maybe he was seeing it a little more than other people, but he wouldn't be the only one making repeat visits. And Tom, how have you felt about Kong over the years, and your early friendship with Greg?
Yeah, well, you know, really, King Kong was a cinematic experience of my lifetime. I mean, it maybe isn't my all-time favorite film, but the first time I saw it was definitely my all-time favorite cinematic experience. That occurred about 10 years after I learned about King Kong. So me and Greg were friends in early grade school, and we started to become aware of famous monsters and other monster magazines, and started to watch movies on the late night channel and afternoons where they'd show the horror and creature features. But they never showed King Kong on our local TV stations. And it took us until 1976 in August, where we finally got to see it at Cleveland State University during a special showing before the re-release of the remake. It was just such amazing experience. The sound, the orchestration, the sound effects. I mean, it's one of those things where it's like better than you ever imagined. And I think that other people experience the same thing. There was Ray Harryhausen, when he saw it, was like, it probably just really took his breath away. Yeah.
Most times I go to see a film, if I'm really excited, it usually disappoints me. Kong was a film I was excited to see. I was thinking it could be the best film ever made from what I was hearing from people I knew that had seen it, that had similar tastes than me. And it was better than I had thought when I walked in. I mean, that Stegosaurus charge when he comes towards Carl Denham just blew my mind. And then the fight with the meat eater. You can argue whether it's an Allosaurus or a Rex. I mean, I know paleontologists that will still argue that. But
So it was really an influential film in my life as well, not only interest in, you know, you know, my own sort of interest of making monsters and creatures and things like that, but also have seen it on a college campus, the first time I ever stepped on a college campus, and it just like saw people are interested in these kind of things. It's like it really inspired me to want to go into academics to be part of that environment.
That's excellent. And now this exhibition, it covers not just King Kong, it covers quite a long period of time where we're seeing Willis O'Brien's earliest works through to The Lost World, King Kong, Son of Kong, Mighty Joe Young, some of his later films, and then the people that that influenced, including Ray Harryhausen, Jim Danforth, and Tim Burton, and the chaps that made Jurassic Park. So, you know, it's really a history of stop-motion art. Could each of you tell me what your highlights are from the exhibition, which artworks you're most excited about?
Okay, well, I guess I'll start. My favorite piece is it's a piece that is probably from This Is Cinerama. And Cinerama was in the early 1950s, and television was competing now with movies, and movies needed to somehow get bigger to compete with television because they wanted to get people out of there and pay for a seat in a theater as opposed to sitting home free. So Marion Cooper was making This Is Cinerama. He came out of the project a little after it started, and he pulled in a lot of the King Kong team. Actually, most people might not know this, but he pulled in Ruth Rose, who co-wrote King Kong, and the co-director of King Kong, Ernest Chodzak, to work on the prologue and some other pieces of the film, and he pulled in Willis O'Brien as a technical consultant to work on the film. It's not clear, but this is likely a piece of art that was meant by Obie, Willis O'Brien, to be a part of an intro to the film where it discusses the history of theater, right? The history of performance theater, which led up to This Is Cinerama being the latest form of high art, right? Multi-channel sound, widescreen, and color, everything. And to me, it's a wonderful piece, not only because of where it fits in film history and this, it beautifully captures, it's a dinosaur, a sauropod, basically like a brontosaurus, rolling kind of on a ball in front of a caveman, and the cavemen are all in almost in a theater watching a show, watching this dinosaur perform. There's another triceratops on the third panel. It's very humorous. It's technically interesting because of how O'Brien split the work between the three cameras. It's visually very imaginative, and it also happened to be the very first Willis O'Brien piece I ever did procure. So it has another special place in my heart because of that. But even if it wasn't the first piece, it might still be my favorite because it captures so many things in one fairly small piece of art.
Well, there are so many wonderful artworks in the exhibition. The O'Brien things I really, really love. I guess if I had to pick one favorite, it would be a double-sided sketch that Ray Harryhausen did in his early years, maybe in his 20s. And on one side features a sort of Charles Knight-inspired leaping allosaurus, and the other side is an alien with tentacles or... how would you describe
it's some sort of
spider legs,
or something. Yeah.
But anyways, I just feel it's a wonderful drawing. He also has a little sketch there of the gorilla, which may be a Kong reference. But it's an early work, and you kind of see how he's struggling with his drawing. And I always took inspiration from Harryhausen, not only from his films, which I really love, but also the man himself and how. You know, our exhibition is about visualization with someone with vision. He's the perfect demonstration of a man with vision and with follow through, and how hard he worked in his art, in his animation, but also in his drawing. So it's rather crude by later standards, but it shows that he's like really struggling and working with his drawing skills. And I always took inspiration from that, of someone like him who, you know, wanted to do something that just went ahead and kind of worked really hard to do it. So I really, really like that drawing for that reason. It's almost like something I would find in my sketchbook or, you know, I'm doodling this and that on different sides of the paper. So I can kind of really relate to it. And in addition, it's really wonderful imagery, particularly the alien on the backside with the spider legs.
And Ben, I'm going to ask you a double question. Could you tell us a little bit about one of the pieces that you've provided for the exhibit, and then maybe something new that you've seen while visiting?
Some of the pieces that we've provided are some visualizations for the unproduced Food of the Gods production that Willis O'Brien did. And they'll show, one is particular, you know, this is where, as the story goes, there's some kind of superfood created that will grow things super large as well when they consume them. And so these chickens get, you know, as large as horses in one scene, and that's on a paneled board where you can see kind of the humor of these gigantic chickens and how a farmer might react to those, to find those in his pen. And then along with another charcoal sketch or graphite sketch where there's these giant rats that are attacking then a stagecoach type, you know, a carriage with multiple horses, and the dynamic motion and kind of viciousness of these rats attacking these horses just really leaps off the page. And both of those, you know, since it was a project that was unrealized, it kind of just releases our imagination by giving us a sense of what Willis O'Brien was imagining, and really kicks us off to fill in the rest of how this might be. And so those are really imaginative pieces, really interesting to look at.
Well, yeah, because I would have selected Food of the Gods as well, actually, as one of my highlights, because Ray Harryhausen has his own unmade Food of the God project, which again involved giant chickens and all sorts. But that drawing of the rats overtaking a carriage is so dramatic looking and really wonderful to see. But I think probably one of the nicest objects in the entire exhibit is your own copy of Famous Monsters of Finland from the 1960s. This one piece which set the ball in motion for a lifetime of friendship and a lifetime of collecting, and it's culminated in this wonderful exhibition.
Well, that actually started with the Sukhan family. So, Tom, do you want to say something about the earliest origins of that Famous Monsters issue?
Well, I believe it was my brother acquired it from a friend, and he brought it home. He said he traded some baseball cards for it. There are actually two or three different Famous Monsters that came along with it, and eventually he tore the cover off. I forget what happened, maybe in a fight with my younger brother, and then I acquired it from him. I forget how, but I managed to get it, and I kept it for a couple years. Then Greg convinced me to trade it for a copy of Frankenstein, I believe
yeah, so.
Paperback. Yeah. So I think we traded it in maybe third grade, and Greg has maintained it ever since.
Yeah, and it's it has an article in it. This is the Famous Monsters 1962 annual, which also happens to be the year Willis O'Brien passed away, so there's maybe multiple connections, although this came out before O.B. passed away. It has an article in it called Confidentially Yours, as Forey would always use a pun in his magazine, but it was some of the early photos that I saw from Kong, and this piece, it's extremely tattered, to say the least, but I was never going to part with it, as it was such an early memory of so many things. And actually, one of the first times I met Forey and was able to have an opportunity to have him sign something, I selected that item, that magazine, as the thing I was going to have him sign. And it was kind of funny, because as everybody else was walking up with their near complete collector's copy, you know, very nice condition, early issues of Famous Monsters, I walked up with him with this completely battered old copy, but I think he knew that I loved that thing, so it, you know, I think Forey got a kick out of signing it, Dr. Acula, as he would at that point in time, and I don't plan on trading that item ever, not even for, any kind of baseball cards for sure.
But I love that. That's the story of eternal inspiration as a teenager, which is what Ray received from King Kong, and which what you guys have received from the film and from Willis O'Brien's artwork and from Ray Harryhausen's creations. And you know, I love the idea of something sustaining you through the decades, that ongoing inspiration. anything else.
Well, I really want to thank you for visiting, and also Ben, and also Greg, for all of your generosity. One thing I think about, like, Harry Alzen was how generous he was with his fans, and the generosity of maintaining his collection together for people to study and to see in a coherent, it's totally coherent. So I really appreciate that. And I really appreciate Greg's friendship and his generosity to allow for his artworks to be exhibited here and all the time that he's invested into this exhibition and project.
I will second that. Thank you. And I will second that. And Tom writing all the grants and getting this funding was a big deal. I want to talk to some of the collectors that are out there a little bit, actually, because you know, most people will probably think, I'm going to wait for a museum. You know, maybe someday my collection will be seen, or an item will be seen in a museum. But you don't have to wait, right? I mean, you know, if you've got something that the public should see, part of what we wanted to do was the view that some of this should be seen and it wasn't being seen. And we actually had talked to more collectors, some that were, I think, a little leery of a project that was going to be across the country from where their art was, and didn't want to take it out of their hands. Others that I think were willing to donate or loan some artwork for the exhibit that probably didn't, because of the pandemic complicating things and questioned whether the opening date going to happen, were we really on track, and were there anything else that was going to derail this. So I would just say, if people out there have a collection of items, you know, let's find ways to get people to see it, right? People love to see it. I love to walk through this exhibit and find somebody that's looking at a piece of art that might be very familiar with Willis O'Brien's or Ray Harryhausen's work, and they see a piece of art that they're not familiar with, and that's kind of cool, and I think I'd like to try to see if we can inspire the next generation as much as possible to keep on promoting these types of films, so... That would be my plea for let's keep more things like this going. It'd be worth it.
Display this artwork. And Ben, where can people find out a little bit more about your work at BYU and some of the projects that you've got on the go?
Yeah, so at BYU, our library has a web page and things, and so and in our special collections, we highlight some of our top collections, and our top cinema related collections would be, we have the Cecil B. DeMille papers, of course Marion C. Cooper and Max Steiner, which we've mentioned, and then some papers from Jimmy Stewart and some others. So we have some wonderful collections. Thankfully, we're supported by the university and the library system as a whole, where those things are cataloged and where there are some neat finding aids where you can get an idea of what we have. But the best way is to reach out and contact me. So, you know, my contact information is there, and I would love to hear from anyone interested in what we have, and I can give better descriptions over the phone or even in person.
That's lovely. Well, thanks. Thank you all so much. That's a really
nice thanks, Connor.
Thank you.
How fascinating, Connor. And of course, for people watching who and listening who maybe don't know the full story, Ray Harryhausen, of course, was inspired by King Kong in 1933 when he was 13 years old, and then went to work with King Kong's creator, Willis O'Brien, on The Mighty Joe Young. And that was Ray's first professional feature film credits on The Mighty Joe Young, but really a pivotal film in Ray Harryhausen's life, as well as culturally. King Kong is considered to be one of the great landmarks in cinema history. But of course, without King Kong, Ray Harryhausen wouldn't have been inspired to have had the career that he did.
Yes, that's right. And I think that's why it's so important to us, particularly. It's lovely that Ray was able to meet and learn from Willis O'Brien and befriend him for so many years as he was starting out on his own career. And really, I suppose, by the latter years of Ray's life, he was one of the people really furthering the legacy of King Kong. He was somebody that knew Willis O'Brien well and knew O'Brien's widow, Darlene, as well. So a really nice overlap there. I think we talked quite a lot about how you can fold history, how the history of special effects movies, really, you know, Ray Harryhausen shook hands with Willis O'Brien, Ray Harryhausen then shook hands with Phil Tippett, and there you have a century of incredible films just within two handshakes. So, we had a lovely time. I did two presentations at the at the Eastern Michigan University, looking not only at the Foundation's collection, but material that we have that specifically relates to Willis O'Brien. And, you know, a really special event all round, and an honour to celebrate 90 years of King Kong. We also had a special screening of King Kong in the UK back in May at the Forbidden Worlds Film Festival on an IMAX screen, which is really a kind of breathtaking event. Seeing it on that size of screen, the restored version of the film, you know, you're seeing it as the people in 1933 would have experienced the movie. So a big shout out to the Forbidden Worlds team, Timon Singh and the rest of his diligent festival team, helping to celebrate the legacy of King Kong and of Ray Harryhausen.
And of course, when we think of King Kong's legacy, Kong is still with us in other film versions. Ray Harryhausen himself tried to make a version of King Kong. You can read all about that in my book, Harryhausen, Lost Movies. Sadly, that didn't happen. But King Kong continues in popular culture. There's been recent King Kong versus Godzillas. And I know fans of the original 1933 believe that's the standard to which no King Kong film has met yet. But Peter Jackson's film was enormously successful in 2005. I'm personally a big fan of the 1976 Dino De Laurentiis, John Guilliman King Kong. I know that people are shocked when I say that. And I've spoken to Ray about that in the past. But there are some great special effects in there. It's not a comparable piece, but it was a successful film and still works. And that's had a 4K restoration by the folks down at Studio Canal in partnership with Paramount Pictures. And for those who are Kong completists, and some people have to cover their ears when I say this title, we should have a warning triangle. King Kong Lives from 1986, the sequel to 76's King Kong, has had a HD release for the first time, and that's available now on Blu-ray as well. And it looks really splendid, and there's some interesting extras on there you can find out about the film. For those of you who are completists and specialists, you can take your hands out of your ears now, because I'm not talking about the Dino Kongs anymore. And also for fans of Kong and those who are interested in what happened next after Son of Kong, it was, of course, Mighty Joe Young. And I've just created an unboxing video for that you can see on the Harryhausen YouTube channel or on my channel here at Walsh Bros. And if you comment below the video and subscribe to the channel, you're in with a chance of winning your very own Mighty Joe Young. And of course, for many people, Mighty Joe is the natural successor to Kong, because he was created, of course, by Willis O'Brien, and Ray Harryhausen was working there for the first time on Mighty Joe. The animation and the compositions and the rear screen projections, the whole composite of it is really quite wonderful. And I think it deserved the Oscar, Connor, that it won, didn't it?
Yes, definitely. Mighty Joe Young is a companion piece, definitely, to the original King Kong, but it's a fantastic film in its own right. And I was speaking to somebody from the States very recently who said they still watch it with their family every Thanksgiving. It appears to be a bit of a Thanksgiving tradition in the USA to watch Mighty Joe Young. And we've spoken to some very high-profile fans of that film. I remember your commentary with John Landis, where he spoke about how much Mighty Joe Young meant to him. So a very special movie. And again, you know, Ray Harryhausen worked on that film as the first animator alongside Willis O'Brien as the supervisor, and really nice overlap there between two legendary creators of special effects.
That's right, yes. And we asked John Landis, which film would you like to sit with Ray Harryhausen and chat with him about for this commentary record season that we did? And he immediately said, oh, Mighty Joe Young, please. And he was wonderful. You know, John Landis is obviously a legendary film director, but a famous raconteur as well. And he drew out many interesting conversations. And we hope one day to release that commentary record with the folks there down at the Warner Brothers archive. And we're still championing a 4K restoration, we hope, for Clash of the Titans. And we're very hopeful there the folks down at Warner Archive will eventually do that one. I hope they get around to it very soon.
Yes, Clash of the Titans as well. I suppose we're looking now towards the 45th anniversary of Clash of the Titans in a couple of years' time. But a film which still lives large in the imagination, which we have many people telling us how much that movie means to them, and begging for a 4K restoration. And so it would be very popular from film fans everywhere. I'm sure it would be a fantastic release to see.
Well, I think maybe for a future podcast or a vodcast, if there's anyone out there who feels very strongly about Clash of the Titans, either way, that it should or it shouldn't. If it shouldn't, you're in for a bit of a ride of it with us here at the Foundation. But maybe we can have a future podcast where we discuss the pros and cons of a 4K restoration for a film that was made in a much more chemical, photochemical world. And would it suit an upscale to 4K? I believe it would, but some people believe it wouldn't. So maybe you can contact us at the usual addresses and through our social medias, and we can have a kind of a discussion here online. It could be fiery, Connor, couldn't it?
Yeah, people are very, very passionate about films and restorations and perceived changes that are being made to the original movies. I think you've spoken before about being with Ray when he was contacted about a restoration of Jason and the Argonauts, and maybe the flaws that the upscaling was perhaps revealing in the original film, and whether those should be airbrushed out or not. And Ray was very much of the opinion that he wanted the films to look as good as they possibly could.
Yes, I mean, Ray was very much pragmatic about these things and felt that you needed to embrace new technologies. We have stereo mixes on his films. Nobody objects to that. High quality digital, high definition picture. I don't think people object to that. And the removal of dirt and hairs and what's called straightening the gate and fixing gates so there's no sort of movement within the frame. But I think some people draw the line at wire removal. And I know that Ray was contacted by Grover Chris from the Columbia Archive down there at Sony and asked, did he want the wires removed from the harpy sequence digitally for Jason the Argonauts? And Ray was very much of the opinion that they should. And he asked me, lowly me, and I said, if I'm answering honestly, I'd have to say perhaps no, but it's very much your choice. And of course, Ray coloured some of his previous black and white classics with some colorization experts there in Hollywood. The original versions are available, of course. And with all of these things, if there is some technical changes to the picture and the sound, I think once the original films are still there to view, I think that's fine. I don't think we're looking at a Star Wars situation where the original films were digitally altered and new characters were overlaid previous characters. I think the worst example of that, the one that most sticks out in my mind, is Cy Snoodles and the Max Rebo Band in Jabba's Palace. There was a great track that they sang on the original film, and the puppetry that was created there kind of really worked in that smoky atmosphere. Now you have these digital clowns jumping around, but
I'm going to give you
what Lucasfilm are doing.
I'm going to give you a counter argument to that, though, John. I've just sat and watched all of the original Star Wars trilogy with my 6-year-old son. And during that particular scene in Jabba's Palace, he turned to me and went, I love this film. It really kind of appeals to the younger audience. He also said that the Phantom Menace was his favorite of the Star Wars films that we watched. So I guess George Lucas knows what he's doing really deep down, because it does seem to just net in a new generation. Every little tweak that's made to those original Star Wars films seems to capture a new audience of young people. And I remember growing up, because I've got much younger brothers, they didn't really see the difference between the prequel trilogy and the original trilogy. They just saw them all as great Star Wars films. But it gives us something to talk about. It certainly inspires a lot of debate among film fans.
Absolutely. If we think all the way back to 1983's Return of the Jedi, when the Ewoks came on, people were like, well, hang on, what's going on here? And yet it drew many young people in, as you say. Many people were like, Ewoks were the entry points for much younger viewers who are watching. So absolutely. It's definitely a sign that we're getting old when we complain about the films being changed. I liked it the way it was, so it's a sign of age there. Don't let the filters on this video fool you, but we're both very old, aren't we, Connor?
Yeah, I think I seem to be getting older than you, but somehow I could be catching up. I think, again, I spoke about my 6-year-old son there. That's definitely, I'm definitely feeling more elderly and, well, wiser, I guess. Maybe wiser is the word, when I get to see how things are changing. I think we all like things the way we remember them, but yes, the world marches on.
The world marches on indeed, and so does these podcasts. We'll have to bring this one to a close here. But as before, please contact us with any questions you have about anything you've heard in the podcast. You can contact us via rayharryhausen.com and find out our social media links. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time. Copyright in the Ray Harryhausen podcast is owned by the Ray and Diana Harryhausen Foundation, a registered Scottish charity, number SC001419, in the year 2023. This recording may not be used or repurposed in whole or in part without written permission from the Foundation. The views expressed within these podcasts do not necessarily reflect those of the Foundation, its trustees or employees. For further terms and conditions, please contact us at rayharryhausen.com, where you can find our social media links. Thank you.